Well, Barry Nice to ask me to come here tonight and read a story. I've found that at most universities, a storyteller is tolerated as long as some abstract statement can be wrung out of him. He's apt to find himself reduced to making comments about his own stories or other people's. And the process leaves him very much like the handsome hero of Poe's story. The one who, before he went to bed at night, removed his wooden arm and his wooden leg and his teeth and his voice box and his wig and his glass eye. What was left of him was not impressive. With this much said, I should let well enough alone and go ahead and read my story. But since the story I want to read is considered grotesque, and since for many people the word grotesque is a description tending to be pejorative, and I feel I might as well hazard a few comments about the kind of story this is and about what makes it that way. I've discovered that any fiction that comes out of the South is going to be called grotesque by the Northern reader. Unless it is grotesque, in which case it's going to be called realistic. When my fiction first began to receive some attention, it was generally considered to have come out of that mythical entity, the School of Southern Degeneracy. Every time I heard about the School of Southern Degeneracy, I felt like Brer Rabbit stuck on the tar baby. I think the social sciences have cast a dreary blight on the public approach to fiction. If you write about people who don't always wear shoes, someone is bound to think that you consider shoes important. Anyway, if you have once got rid of a label like the School of Southern Degeneracy, you accept the label grotesque with better grace. Essentially, any writer who produces stories that can be called grotesque does so because he has that kind of a talent. But I believe that in addition, there are reasons that intensify the grotesque quality of some writing in these times. I feel that the grotesque quality of my own work is intensified by the fact that I am both a Southern and a Catholic writer. It's standard for the Catholic writer to say that he is not a Catholic writer, but a writer who happens to be a Catholic. This is a formula that has its uses. But I often wish that Cardinal Spellman had said it instead of Mr. Graham Greene. Then we would have heard no more about it. I've always been more tempted to say that I'm not a Southern writer, but a writer who happens to be a Southerner. However, I feel that both of these are evasions, and that they stop discussions that they ought to begin. The Southern writer can't escape the image of the South that has built up a life of its own in his senses, any more than the Catholic can escape the indelible marks that the sacraments put on his soul. The Southerner's sense of place is usually as unadjustable as the believing Catholic's sense of right and wrong. I think a writer from Minnesota might be able to go to Japan and stay a few months and write a story about credible Japanese. But if I went and tried to write a story about credible Japanese, all my Japanese would sound like Herman Talmadge or Hazel Moat. Whenever I'm asked why Southern writers particularly have a penchant for writing about freaks, I say it's because we are still able to recognize one. To be able to recognize a freak, you'd have to have some conception of the whole man. And in the South, the general conception of man is still theological. Now that is a big statement, and it's dangerous to make it. Almost anything you affirm on the subject of Southern belief can be denied in the next breath with equal propriety. I'm sure some poll taker could come along and get up a table to prove that the South doesn't believe anything at all. But approaching the subject from the standpoint of the writer, I think it's quite safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it is most certainly Christ-haunted. The Southerner who isn't convinced of it is very much afraid that he may have been formed in the image and likeness of God. And ghosts can be very fierce and instructive. They cast strange shadows, particularly in our literature. In any case, it's when the freak can be sensed as a figure for our essential displacement that he attains some depth in literature. All this is changing, of course. The ghost is being exorcised. In 20 years, the Southern writer may be writing about men in gray flannel suits and may have lost his ability to see that these gentlemen are even greater freaks than what we're writing about now. But for the present, Southern literature abounds an example of the grotesque, and it is a kind of grotesque that is much more complicated and serious than 19th century grotesque writing, or than the kind of grotesque fiction that Erskine Caldwell turned out in the 30s. A good many people believe, of course, that Southern writing tends to the grotesque, not because we are still able to recognize freaks, but because in the South there are so many more freaks to recognize. I just don't take that up. Still others seem to have decided that if you write about freaks, you do so on account of your great compassion. It's considered an absolute necessity these days for writers to have compassion. Compassion is a word that sounds good in anybody's mouth, and which no book jacket can do without. It's a quality that no one can put his finger on in any exact critical sense, and so the word is always safe for anybody to use. Thomas Mann has said that the grotesque is the true anti-bourgeois style. But I think that the kind of hazy compassion demanded of the writer now makes it difficult for him to be anti-anything. Certainly, when the grotesque has a legitimate reason for being, it will be used in a way that gives to the intellectual and moral judgments implicit in it the ascendancy over feeling. In 19th century American writing, there was a good deal of grotesque literature which came from the frontier and was supposed to be funny. But our present grotesque heroes, if they are comic, are at least not primarily so. They seem to carry an invisible burden. Their fanaticism is a reproach, not merely an eccentricity. I think they are figures that come about from the kind of vision peculiar to the writer who is concerned with a larger stretch of reality than can be accounted for by a naturalistic view of the world. You can call it prophetic vision, because this kind of writer is the kind of realist the prophet is. He's a realist of distances. Henry James said that in his fiction, he did things a way that took the most doing. I think the writer of grotesque fiction does them in the way that takes the least, because in his work, distances are so great. He's looking for one image that will connect two points. One is a point in the concrete, and the other is a point not visible to the naked eye, but believed in by him firmly, more real to him, really, than what everybody sees. It's not necessary to point out that the look of this fiction is going to be wild, that it's going to tend toward poetry and not toward sociology, that it's almost of necessity going to be violent and comic because of the discrepancies that it seeks to combine. At some point along the line of American literature, the grotesque has become intermingled with the tradition of the romance novel that has come down to us from Hawthorne and Melville. But writers whose fiction is grotesque have learned so much from the naturalist that their work is often thought to be realism when it isn't at all. We are able to make things real that, for the reader, have no business being, or things seem typical that are only possible. I'm always having it pointed out to me that life in Georgia is not at all the way I depict it, that escaped criminals do not roam the roads exterminating families, nor Bible salesmen prowl about looking for girls with wooden legs. It's very hard to get it across that where you belong is with the writers of romance. A little romance I'm going to read you tonight is called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. A grandmother didn't want to go to Florida.